Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we're talking with a man at the center of the storm that followed the shooting death of Michael Brown. Tom Jackson, a professional career police officer, was chief of the Ferguson Police Department at the time of the shooting. It was one of his officers, Darren Wilson, who fatally shot Brown. Chief Jackson's written a book about the incident. It's titled Policing Ferguson, Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn From It. He joins me in studio. Chief, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
You know, I had to wonder in reading your book how difficult it might have been for you to relive those months following the shooting.
It was extremely difficult. Yeah. Thanks for recognizing that because we did have to, you know, go through it in quite a lot of detail and just recalling a lot of what was just a really – really bad experience for everybody.
Yeah, I sense a certain degree of anger in your writing and in your presentation.
Well, I think that the people, the editors and publishers that were helping me with this book, filter out a lot of the anger. So what you're seeing in there is hushed a little bit. But yeah,
but so there's anger. Plenty of it. Does it persist?
Well, it helps to get my side of the story out and Ferguson's side and all the officers who were out there every day. It does help to get that side of the story out.
Where is this anger directed?
At the time, it was very quickly noticed by us that politicians had pretty much thrown law enforcement under the bus, and some of them who I'd worked with on various issues throughout the years, you know, in my volunteer work, and so. That was really heart-wrenching to see how quickly they were able to believe the worst. And then, the way social media put out things, without any filters at all, without any verification or things like that. So the story went out quickly that there'd been this bad shooting and that the man was surrendering with his hands in the air and an officer shot him down in cold blood midday on a hot August afternoon on a Saturday. And if you believe that, then rage follows very quickly. And that went out to essentially the world, that story. And we were never able to get in front of that story. We weren't very good at putting out a message, you know, that would the wait and see message, because it was too late before we even knew it was out there.
Yeah, you mentioned politicians. Are you talking about local politicians, statewide politicians in general?
State and federal. Yeah, yeah. Politicians either spoke in critical terms about the police. I mean, in very harsh terms about the police, or they just seemed to be hiding under their desks.
Yeah. Should this shooting have ever happened?
Well. No officer wants to be involved in a shooting. You know, officers are trained for a million different things, you know, handle family disturbances, to handle traffic accidents, conduct investigations, process crime scenes, and they're also trained to use deadly force. And they're also trained to try as best they can to avoid the use of deadly force. So even though we're trained to use deadly force, I don't know anybody who ever wanted to use it.
I certainly understand that. But the question, of course, since the very moment that this happened, has been whether Darren Wilson should have fired those shots. You've had a lot of time to think about it. What are your thoughts now in retrospect?
Well, in retrospect, they're essentially the same as I had going into it. First of all, I was going to wait to see what happened. I immediately turned the investigation over to the county. I spent 31 years at St. Louis County Police Department. And so I was completely separated from that investigation, just waiting to see what it showed. And, of course, the FBI came in to conduct their investigation as well. And so what the investigation ultimately showed is that, it was a violent encounter initiated by the deceased. And, you know, it resulted in a deadly force situation, which is regrettable.
The violent encounter part has got a couple of sides to that story. There are people who say it wasn't really violent. You have no doubts about what Darren Wilson was telling you.
No. And it wasn't what Darren told me, because I did not interview him about the shooting. I separated myself from it right away and my department from it. But I've read the reports both the county and the FBI report. And the FBI, you know, it's part of the DOJ, but it's different because they're an investigative body, finest in the world, and they go about their business with blinders on. They're not politicized in any way. And if they had found that this was an unjustified shooting under the law, they would have said so.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were two reports. The FBI report followed the Department of Justice report, of which you're very critical in the book. Explain to our audience what it is that you find so objectionable about the DOJ report.
Well, there's absolutely nothing exculpatory in it. It's written as a prosecutor's brief to prove a predetermined conclusion. And that's how I read it, and that's a lot of people who have read it are critical of it for that same reason. One of the things I sent to the DOJ when they were doing this investigation, which a lot of it they admitted privately to us, a lot of the people they interviewed weren't talking about the Ferguson Police Department. But prior to this, 3 months prior to that report being released, there was another report released by the University of Missouri-St. Louis. And it was an extensive survey of the city of Ferguson. The reason we were doing that is in anticipation of an annexation attempt of a neighboring unincorporated area. So the city of Ferguson, the council and the department heads wanted to know in reality, for real terms, was it worth our while to try to do that annexation? So we wanted to know how we were doing as a city. And we, you know, there's a lot of ways that we did that, you know, with our nine neighborhood associations and our newsletter that went to every house. But this report showed that the citizens had a great deal of satisfaction in the city services. And in particular, the police department had a 76% good or excellent rating, in the survey. So, which is really good for urban suburban police department. Mm-hmm. So that absolutely flies in the face of the DOJ report. And another thing, if you look at this, where was all the rage and the outcry about Ferguson in the news prior to that? When you read about Ferguson, it was about our 5K, 10K run, or our bike ride, or something like that. And another thing is Ferguson's member of Congress, my member of Congress, is Lacey Clay. Mm-hmm. Now, Lacey Clay marched in our 4th of July parade in Ferguson every year, shook hands with residents. He's been in my office. I've been in his office, for matters, not necessarily related to policing when I was with the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Never once did we receive criticism from him or the other state representatives and senators who represented mm-hmm. Ferguson. And we'd think if there was policing that was as bad as this report reads, and it's hard to read that report. And if things were that bad, somebody would have said something. Hmm.
But I have to ask about the population and the revelations that came after the shooting. Did you as police chief or your men, was anyone aware of this kind of seething undercurrent, I'll call it, that people that felt that they were being victimized? Now, I go back to the court fees and things which have been well publicized. Mm-hmm. The talks of racial profiling and concern that the African-American population was being beset upon by the police and by society in general. Any indication of that at all?
And again, here's the rub. When they were doing all these interviews of people, it was after thousands of people came into Ferguson and stayed there, once the riot started.
You're talking about people
who from outside the
demonstrators.
Area. Yeah, people who were rioting and looting and demonstrating on a daily basis out there. So and the residents of Ferguson were just trying to get to work, get to school, and they couldn't even get out on their streets. But you have to ask, so how would a police chief or a city determine how well they're doing,
With contact with the people.
Nine neighborhood associations. I went to all their meetings. And we're talking about 6 square miles mm-hmm. here, 20,000 people. Yeah. So I'd go to their monthly meetings. I'd have a commander go. I always had my community resource officer go to all these meetings, to brief them on crime stats and get complaints. And the complaints were usually kids in the park after dark, streetlights being out, potholes, just stuff like that, normal neighborhood stuff. But anybody in the neighborhoods could just come to those meetings. You know, they weren't select committees or, you know, appointed committees or anything like that. It was just open, and I was there, you know, mm-hmm. just like you and I are talking. You ask me whatever you want. And my police members of the police department were there at those meetings too. And we also had a newspaper, a city newspaper that went to every single resident, every address in Ferguson, so that they would, you know, not only have just the feel-good articles and the interesting stuff, but this is how you contact your council member. This is how you contact the city manager. We did an outreach program. Guadalupe Church is one of the largest Spanish-speaking Catholic churches around, and they're in Ferguson. So our city manager had us, the staff, do an outreach program there where we had all our brochures printed up in Spanish, and we'd go to the church, their activities. And what we were trying to do is recruit members of that church to our housing stock, to our businesses and our restaurants and so forth. There was a lot going on where we were just right there in the middle of the community, the apartment complexes in the area where the shooting happened. In the year prior to this shooting, we had gotten together with the owners, not just the managers, but the owners of those apartment complexes, and said, look, you know, you wouldn't live with the quality of life that some of your folks are having to live with here. And we didn't force them, but we convinced them to enter into a public-private partnership with the city where they would do things like put up cameras, have parking stickers for the cars, do gated entrances in some cases, do enhanced background investigations, verify that the people that rented the apartment actually moved in. So all that stuff was going on.
Yeah. Are you suggesting, though, that the complaints that people had were not justified, or are you just saying they weren't communicating that to the people like yourself and your force?
No, everybody's complaint, you know, if that's how they're feeling, that's, you know, mm-hmm. justified. I changed all the policies and procedures when I got there to comply with international standards, CALEA standards. And one of them was to make it easier for citizens to file complaints against officers for, you know, even minor offenses. Mm-hmm. And those complaints came to me, every one of them, and that I would assign them to a commander or a supervisor, depending on the type of complaint, to investigate. And then they reported back to me. And then I would send a letter to the complainant, you know, telling what the outcome of that was. That was our policy. What you're talking about in a lot of cases are people who came to the meetings, you know, with the DOJ or whoever, and they weren't necessarily expressing dissatisfaction with my officers, but with officers.
Are these the people that came to the meetings not with the DOJ necessarily, but the community meetings that you're talking about? Are these the people who ultimately had the complaints? Are these the African American in your community, or the white people in the community, or a mixture of both, or what?
No, all these neighborhood associations were mixed. You know, there's not any, you know, white neighborhoods in Ferguson. Yeah. It's actually a city that was surviving the white flight. You know, it was a Renaissance city. We had, you know, still have a vibrant downtown, and we were doing beautification for the West Florissant corridor with our surrounding neighbors in the St. Louis County, and that was in the pipeline. There's just
but just to be clear, the people you were meeting with in the community meetings were simply not voicing the concerns that ultimately were voiced.
No. Okay. And you know, on occasion, you know, they would voice some concerns, but not this vitriolic stuff that we see.
Got to take a break now. We're talking with Tom Jackson. He's the former police chief in the city of Ferguson. He's written a book about his experiences during those months in which he remained on the force following the Michael Brown shooting. The title of the book is Policing Ferguson, Policing America. We'll be back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
And welcome back as we continue our conversation with the former chief of police of the city of Ferguson, Tom Jackson. We will do that in a moment, but first here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Metro is putting the finishing touches on the newly renovated $10.5 million Civic Center transit facility near Scott Trade Center in downtown St. Louis. The transit center opens Monday and will include easier access to Metro buses and trains, a spot for commuters to pick up a snack, and round-the-clock security. And Normandy High School students can get medical care without leaving campus starting today. Part of the school has been converted into a clinic staffed by a nurse practitioner and a licensed social worker. You can find out more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to continue our conversation with Tom Jackson, former police chief of the city of Ferguson. Chief Jackson, do you think that Darryl Wilson should have gone on trial, that a lot of the subsequent problems might have been averted if he had been tried?
No, absolutely not. He would be tried if there was a finding by either one of the bodies, and there wasn't. So you don't just have a trial for appeasing public violence. We don't want to go into that anarchy rules type of a situation. And frankly, so many of the groups that came in, it got to be sort of like a violent Woodstock in Ferguson, right, where people were coming in just to be part of the, you know, throwing rocks at the police or firing their guns in there, things like that. So we had people that were just there. And as long as the cameras were there and rolling and the violence was continuing, people were just going to keep coming. And we talked to them about that too, you know. I mean, it's not like I didn't have conversations with these people on a daily basis because they were right there in front of me.
During the time of the shooting itself, did Darren Wilson follow procedure, Ferguson police tactical procedure?
You're talking about during the shooting
of Michael Brown.
Both reports found that he did.
Ten shots, was it 10 or 12 shots fired? That would be called for in a situation like this?
Well, it's the training that most officers get is to, you know, fire until the threat is eliminated. Mm-hmm. So, you know, policing is ugly sometimes, and that's one of the things that people are very critical about is the way this thing went down. But the fact is that it went down, and what was found by both the FBI grand jury and the county police department as a justifiable shooting.
In your book, you make much of what is called optics. We're hearing that term a lot these days.
Yeah,
that is how things appear, how they are photographed and what have you. In connection with the optics, one of the most prominent from this particular incident, you know what I'm going to say.
Absolutely. Yeah.
These armored personnel carriers or whatever you want to call them, I think they were called tanks initially, which they were not.
No,
but
they're not.
Officers with sniper rifles. Talk about that. I mean,
sure.
Was that a mistake?
Well, not so much a mistake because the Overwatch is a thing that people trained for, and those vehicles were all belonged to the tactical operations units from, you know, city, county, state, St. Charles County to excuse me. But understand that when those vehicles were first starting to be purchased and made for police departments, it was because of Littleton, Colorado, primarily. Mm-hmm. The officers were training for an active shooting situation at a school.
That's, Columbine, you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, exactly, Columbine. So when we did additional training for those years before this incident, if we were doing additional supplemental training for the region, it was generally an active shooter training. So we were – that's what those vehicles were for, to rescue people and to insert officers into a situation where there was active shooting. There was – and, of course, there was daily gunfire in Ferguson. That's not widely reported, but mm-hmm. it was almost every night that we had gunfire coming from the crowd. So – but ultimately, we – you know, we get together and talk about these things every day and what happened the day before. And we, you know, concluded that we have to try to control the optics that we can control. Mm-hmm. The officers who were up there were just getting a better vantage point. But when you see it on TV or a still picture of it in the paper, it looks horrible.
Would you do it the same way again?
Well, we stopped doing it the same way then.
Mm-hmm.
But
recognizing
was it
the optics or what that caused you to stop doing it?
It was primarily the optics that caused the SWAT teams to change to still keep officers' safety and community safety the number one priority, but just something that wasn't as visually offensive.
Yeah. So speaking of optics, one of the things that was cited in many of the press reports during the whole process was your release of that video of the convenience store incident in which Michael Brown shoved. Why'd you do that?
Why wouldn't I? is the question. Right. Normally, the press, if you've got a video, and that's what they did in this case. You've got a video. We know about it. However it was leaked to them, they found out about it. And so then they were, asking me for it and, filling out an FOI and a napkin or whatever. And then, the local press, a lot of them, I've known you for many, many years back when I was with the St. Louis County Police Department. I do news stories. So a lot of them would just come into my office to talk, And they started asking about this video. Well, we were also getting FOI or Sunshine Requests, Freedom of Information or Sunshine Requests for several things. Many of them, weren't things that we could send, but a lot of them were, we'd get 1,000 requests for the same thing because some of these organizations were mass, requesting us to overload us and things like that. But what we concluded is there were things that we could release. And I talked to all the principals about everything that we had. We concluded that we'd have a press conference, give a packet that had all of our stuff in it that we could release, not counting the county's investigation, the FBI's investigation, just what we had, which was Darren's name, like a timeline of the shooting, and the radio calls, things like that, and this videotape that people were asking for. So that's really all we did. We just released it, and the backlash from it was very surprising to me.
Yeah. If you had a chance to do it over again, would you try to find some way not to release it?
No.
Yeah.
I would have released it sooner. Yeah. I didn't see it until a couple of days before that.
There were some folks who thought, speaking of that press conference, that it wound up being kind of a situation blaming the victim. That was the news conference in which you announced Darren Wilson's name. Any sense of that in your part? I mean, did you feel that that was what was going to be interpreted from this?
I didn't know that was going to happen. Yeah. I was surprised by it because I was assigned all these ulterior motives or these hostile things, that just aren't – they don't fit the way I do things or my personality. But so I was genuinely surprised that there was backlash to that.
Yeah.
It was just something that happened.
I'd like to get a couple of our listeners into the conversation, Chief. Let's do that as time will allow, and we'll start with Ron, who is calling. I'm not sure where he's calling from, but that doesn't make much of a difference, I don't guess. Ron, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm calling from the great city of Ferguson. I've lived there for 25 years. I've been involved in the community. And at one time, one of the former police chiefs lived across the street from me for about a year and a half. And I will say one thing, that every neighborhood meeting I ever went to, there was always a police officer there. And the problems with these tickets and things like that is an economic problem. And so you have people driving through Ferguson who don't have the monies to maintain their cars properly, and they get stopped and they get tickets. But the thing that I find most disturbing about the situation, and I didn't even know this, is that how few African Americans there were on the police force. So you cannot name any other community where the police force does not look like the community. So I think that, to me, that was the biggest failure. The tickets and things like that, that's an economic problem that really doesn't have much to do with the police. It has more to do with the justice, the system, and people having economic woes that they cannot overcome. So they take chances, drive cars that are not properly licensed. They don't have the insurance. The taillights are busted. That's why they get stopped.
Ron, we have your point, and let's give the chief a chance to respond, and we'll take some more calls. Go ahead, Chief.
Sure. talking about the neighborhood association meetings, he's right. We always had officers there. Looking at the economics of you know, people not being able to afford things, and I get that. But also understand that you know, the way Timothy McVeigh was caught was being pulled over for, you know, having an expired plate, and you know, some other pretty bad characters have been, you know, captured just because of that. You know, and traffic enforcement is an important safety issue for all communities. There was another point that he made.
Well, he was talking about the courts.
He was talking about the number of officers, African-American officers, in the police
department. Diversity, yes.
Which was a constant struggle for us. And you know, Ron, if you're still listening, I promoted the first two ever African-American supervisors on the Ferguson Police Department. I always had my my commanders contact the police academy when there was a new academy class to see if there were any unattached recruits who were going to be graduating that would be minority recruits. So and I was losing, you know, I'd have African-American officers who would get better job officers, so that better job officer offers at other communities. So it was often an economic issue for them. Recruiting minority officers in this area is actually very difficult because of the number of police departments, bigger police departments that we have out there that offer more opportunity, you know, detective bureaus and canine handlers and things like that.
Sure. We have another caller here. Willis Johnson is calling from Ferguson. Let's take his call. Go ahead, Willis.
Yeah. Hey, Brother Don, how are you? Chief Jackson. Good day.
Hello.
Hey, I was just kind of calling in. I was intrigued understanding your latest manuscript. You shared your personal account and understanding of the events of Ferguson. I just want to ask, at any point I haven't heard today or deducted from your manuscript, what sense of responsibility or onus do you claim for really how the events of Ferguson rolled out under your administration?
Okay, thanks for that question. In the book, I say pretty much right off the bat that this happened under my watch, and that's part of the analysis that I wanted to do. And I think there's a lot of responsibility to go around for the way things went down, but understand one thing, that people have to take personal responsibility for the destruction that they did. You know, you can be unhappy about something or very angry about something, but that doesn't mean people get to burn down other people's businesses. And we had a lot of that. We had a lot of destruction in the community when that was going on. But as far as, you know, the way the protests were handled on a day-to-day basis and the way the riots were handled, that was an evolving thing for us, you know, as we saw things that could be improved or things that could look better or we could do better, we continued to do that. During the process of the months of the protests, we actually every single officer who was going to be out there had to undergo training. And we had teams formed, you know, with the municipal officers, the county officers, the state, and so forth. So we took the responsibility very seriously. And Willis, one other thing, if you think about it, during the entire time of those protests, the police officers didn't hurt any protesters. So with the word out there that you know, police brutality, and we wanted to hurt citizens, minorities particularly, that would have been an opportunity to do that if, in fact, that's what we wanted to do. And the proof is in the pudding here is that we didn't hurt anybody.
You mentioned Congressman Clay early on, and he is proposing a national legislation now that would require mandatory sensitivity training on the part of police officers across the country. And this is not only because of Ferguson, but because of the spate of shootings, well-publicized shootings that have happened since Ferguson. Good idea?
Oh, sure. Yeah, he's talking about de-escalation training. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, officers get that type of training, but you can never get enough. You know, as the community changes, as the culture changes, you know, it's always going to be an evolving thing to learn about. For example, we had two of our officers trained to teach racial profiling type classes to not just our department, but at the police academy, and they put together one that was understanding Islam and Muslims because of the growing population that was, you know, refugees that was coming into our area to just understand the culture.
Mm-hmm. And prior to the Michael Brown shooting, the sensitivity training in Ferguson was what?
It was, like I said, it was our we had two trainers.
That policy was in place at the time.
And our racial profiling index also, where the state average at the time was about 1.6. During my tenure, ours had gone from 1.7 to 1.31, the lower being the better.
Yeah. Okay. We have a tweet here that I'd like to read to you. Is what has Tom Jackson learned from Michael Brown's death? Does he have sorrow or regret? Does he hold responsibility? The only thing I hear is resentment toward those who held him accountable for his role as police chief.
I have no resentment toward his family. They lost a child, and that's just tragic. And I can't imagine what that would have felt like. Leslie McSpadden actually, at the scene of the shooting, she was there, and she and Anthony Shaheed and I walked the perimeter of the crowd, asking them to calm down and let the police do their job so the scene could be processed. You know, once gunfire had broken out there at the scene, I thought that was very courageous. I couldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your own regret, and your resentment is not focused anywhere else. For instance, demonstrators, out-of-towners who were part of the process?
Well, they came in from out of town and destroyed the town. You know, that's unacceptable.
Yeah.
I don't think that's resentment.
Our time is beginning to wind down. Chief, do you think there is such a thing as the Ferguson effect? We hear about that from time to time, where officers across the country are kind of stepping back. Crime seems to be inching up because officers are afraid of getting involved, a la Darren Wilson or others who've been involved in shootings, for instance.
Well, so there's studies that are suggesting that. I don't think we can just say this happened, therefore this happened. You know, we've got to look at that much more critically because we're talking about law enforcement in the community. But I think the videos and being criticized maybe inappropriately, I think that has an effect on officers. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there was such a turning on the police after this happened, and with all the snipings, I mean, we've had an officer here ambushed. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a possibility that there is something to that.
Of course, the cameras work two ways for cops too, because
sure.
There are times when they are exonerated as a result of videos that are out.
Many times.
There. You have a question here that what do you think of Ferguson being used as kind of a catch-all for all this wrong with policing, if you will?
I hate that. Ferguson was and continues to be a beautiful town with great people, you know, who are resilient, who are they're maintaining their town, they're building it back up, they're reestablishing the good relationships that they had in the community. So to make it sound like a horrible place, it's so out of place.
The time is winding down, but one of the things you point out in the title of your book is you want people to learn from the experience. What can be learned?
Well, some of the things that we learned during this is that social media drives things. You're going to see things and hear things over social media that are not true. And we need people to understand that law enforcement is a difficult profession and that we all have an individual responsibility to be a good citizen in our community. So what we can't do, this is one of the lessons, is put all the responsibilities of a civil society on the police. You know, they've got way too much more responsibility than they should have. As far as, they expect us to socialize people and to solve their family problems and things like that. And we need, as a country, to take individual responsibility for ourselves and our families and take parenting seriously as well.
Only a couple of seconds left. Very, very quickly, you're going to get back into it. You're out of the game now in 10 seconds. Yes or no?
I won't be probably not be back in policing. I don't see it happening anyway.
I want to thank you, former Ferguson Police Chief Tom Jackson, for being with us. I know these conversations have to be difficult for you for a lot of different reasons, but thank you for being with us.
It's good talking to you.
His book is Policing Ferguson, Policing America, What Really Happened and What the Country Can Learn from It. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.